Hebrews chapter 10 is when we're going to start reading here in just a few moments. Hebrews chapter 10. Please turn your Bibles to that passage. This topic has been on my mind, and we touched a little bit on it in last week's sermon, but it still hasn't left me yet. So I felt compelled to continue talking about our need to do what this phrase tells us to do. It's buried in the middle of the passage that we're going to read in just a few moments. And it's not just there, it's in several places throughout Paul's writings. And if Paul mentioned it several times, I'm going to say it's because it was important to him. And if it was important to him, it's important to us as Christians. Let's read it together. Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 23. The inspired writer writes, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another and all the more as you see the day drawing near." There are a couple of things in here that help us to zero in on what Paul wants us to do, or the Hebrew writer. I say it's Paul, I don't know for sure. But one of the things that he begins with is to think about the one who promised to us, to think about the faithfulness of God, to think about the faithfulness of Jesus. He who promised is faithful. And when we look, as we did during the Lord's Supper, at the promise of the coming Messiah, at the work that he would do, and how those promises were fulfilled in Jesus, and how Jesus was steadfastly loyal in his mission on our behalf, we can know that if we look to the faithfulness of God, that we can certainly take what he says as his will for us. And not only that, he says, this is how we do it. By considering one another. In verse 24, let's consider how to stir up one another to love and to good works. And so the basis of this stirring up, or the basis of this consideration for one another, is love. It's the first thing he mentions. Make a left with me to John chapter 13. John 13. In John 13, Jesus speaks of the love that he commands. And so that tells us something. That love is more than a warm, mushy, affectionate feeling. I mean, it's good if you can get that. But it's more than that. Because it can be commanded. It's a decision that you and I make. And so Jesus says in John 13 and verse 34, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another, and by this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." So Jesus not only commands love, but he commands a certain kind of love, a love that is based on the kind of love that he had for us. And if you just were to think about some qualities or some traits or characteristics of that love, you might think of words like selfless, or compassionate, or sacrificial, or considerate. That's the kind of love that the Hebrew writer is calling us to consider for one another. So, how are we going to do this? How are we going to consider one another in love? Well, I've got some ideas for us, no surprise, and we'll be looking at them this morning. The first thing we need to realize is the relationship that we share. We should consider one another as family. And there are several things that the Bible calls us in the Bible. We are sometimes referred to as saints. We are sometimes referred to as disciples. But the one word that is used over and over and over and over again to refer to those who have a common bond in Jesus is brethren, because we're family. And it describes us as being in a household. In 1 Timothy 3, verse 15, Paul wrote to Timothy and said, "If I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and buttress of the truth." He wrote again in Ephesians 2, verse 19, "So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." Now, I don't know about your family, but my bunch is very family-oriented. As often as we can, we get together. And I like that we have become a close family. Not every family has that. I get that. I understand that. But really, when you think about it, can you think of a relationship that really relates the idea of closeness and relationship more than family or more than household? So this idea that we are not just people who meet together to go to church, we're not just people with whom we work to accomplish God's purpose in our community, we have a relationship with one another is the motivation for how we relate to one another. Go with me to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5, look with me in verse 1 and 2. 1 Timothy 5, in verse 1, the inspired apostle says, "Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, in all purity." Paul's point, or at least one of them, I think, in this passage, is the fact that if we really consider that we have this relationship that ties us together, a relationship that's deeper than merely co-workers, the relationship that says we share in a common bond that we don't share with anybody else in the world, it's going to drive how we relate to one another. It's going to encompass this sphere of relationship that we share. And Paul tells us we need to consider one another in this relationship as we work to relate to one another. And maybe that'll help some of the difficult conversations that we have to have sometimes with folks who aren't acting in the best interest of the family. So what I want you to ask yourself this morning as we continue to go through this lesson is really a very simple question. Think about yourself and ask yourself this. How can I use whatever talents I have, whatever my abilities are that God has given to me, how can I use what God has given to me to help other members of my family at Eastside? I'll give you another idea. We can consider one another not only as family, but if we do that, we'll consider one another in physical weakness. And that's important because some of us do better than others. Some of us have more than others. And some of us experience loss, perhaps more than others. It may be financial loss. It may be loss of physical strength. It may be loss of health. But I want you to realize something. When you reach out to someone in whatever physical need that they have, Jesus tells us that blessing your brethren is blessing him. In Matthew chapter 25, if you'll go there with me, in Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew chapter 25, there is a separation that takes place. There are the sheep on the right hand, the goats on the left, and we're not left to wonder what that represents. The ones who are blessed are on Jesus' right hand, the ones who are cursed are on his left. And so he tells those who are blessed in verse 34, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom." And then he goes on to tell them why they get to do this. He says, "I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And so he says, there are some who are going to say, when did all that happen? We don't remember doing any of that stuff for you. In verse 40, Jesus says, "The king will answer them, 'Truly, I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me.'" And then he goes on to address those who were on the left, the goats, the ones who didn't do it. He says, "You didn't do any of this stuff." And they said, "When didn't we do that for you?" And Jesus uses the same answer, except in the inverse. He says, "Just as you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it to me." And that ought to get us to stop for a moment and think about how important it is, this reaching out that we ought to do, that we constantly urge and exhort one another to do. It's not merely to help or relieve the needs of someone who's going through a difficult time, someone who needs something taken care of. It's because of who we are and whose we are. And so as we seek to relieve the need for one another, we should recognize that not only is blessing others a blessing to Jesus, but it means that we're going to have to keep our eyes open to recognize these opportunities. And I'll tell you why. Because sometimes brethren don't always let other brethren know when they have a need that need to be met. I've known some brethren who obviously needed something, and I've offered to it, and they said, no, I've never asked anybody for help, and I'm not going to ask them now. And I've tried to explain, well, you're making me lose out on a blessing. You're making me lose out on the privilege that I have to offer whatever I can to you. And you know as well as I do that there are some folks who are rigid in their belief, and they're just not going to ask for help. But that doesn't mean that we don't stop looking for opportunities. In 1 John chapter 3, if you'll go there with me, maybe you're already there. In 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 16, John says, "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." Now, I don't know if I could do that literally. I'll be honest with you. But I don't think that we necessarily have to go that far. I think in the very next few verses, John tells us it's not necessarily literally laying down your life. It's laying down the things in your life that will help others. He tells us in verse 17, "But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us love in word. Let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." Look at a companion passage to this, James chapter 2. James chapter 2. In James 2, begin with me if you will in verse 15. James 2 and in verse 15. James says, "If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and filled,' without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that?" He refers to it as dead faith. If you don't act on what you know the need is, he says, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now maybe it's not just food or drink or clothing. Maybe you can think of somebody in this congregation who you know needs something. And maybe you think that nobody else knows that this need exists, but I do. Just knowing that it's there gives you the responsibility, the obligation, not only to your brother or sister, but to the Lord of your brother and sister, to act upon that, to consider one another in physical weakness. And as we're talking about weakness, well, it's fair to say that we should also consider one another in spiritual weakness. And I want to say this. That doesn't mean that the one who is reaching out to someone else spiritually, or someone with a spiritual struggle, is better than the other person. Because the plain truth is that we all struggle. We all stumble. And Paul is honest about this. In Romans chapter 7, if you'll go there with me. In Romans 7, begin with me in verse 19. In Romans 7 and in verse 19, Paul is self-critically honest about the struggles that he himself had to endure. He says, "For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members." Now, Paul is just being brutally honest here. He's saying, I want to do the right thing. In fact, he says, I know about what God's law says and I love it. I concur with it. I think it's good. I think it's right. I think we ought to do it. But he says, I see something else happening. In fact, in spite of the knowledge that I have, in spite of the motivation that I have to do what's right, he says, sometimes I find myself doing the absolutely wrong thing. Man, Paul, can you get an amen? How many of us have been there? I have, probably more often than I would care to admit. I think about things that I've done, and even while knowing that this is not the kind of thing I should be doing, afterward I slap myself on the forehead and say, "You knew better." I can imagine Paul doing the same thing. You knew better. And yet, we struggle. But just because we struggle doesn't for a moment let us off the hook. It still means we have the responsibility to one another. In Galatians chapter 6, if you go there with me. In Galatians 6, the first couple of verses, in fact, most of this chapter is all about spirituality and how it's exercised. In Galatians 6 and verse 1, Paul says, "Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." Paul says, "Yeah, I know you struggle. I struggle too," Paul had told us before. But he says, still, when you see someone else, reach out to them. Do the best you can to restore them. Maybe you see someone that has been overtaken in a sin that no one else knows about. Maybe it's a sin against you. Maybe it's an offense that someone has committed against you. What are you going to do? You're going to ostracize them? You're going to single them out, point them out? You're going to talk to others about them, about how they have wronged you or wronged someone else? That's not what Jesus says we should do. Jesus said in Matthew 18, verse 15, "If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother." Notice what Jesus didn't say. He didn't say, "Go and ream this guy out. Go and show him what's what, because then you've won your argument." Jesus said, "Talk to him in private. Show him what he's done. And if he listens to you, you've not won the argument," Jesus said. "You won your brother." And isn't that the point? Sometimes the best thing that we can do for someone is to bring them back from the wrong path. In James chapter 5, go back to James with me. In James chapter 5, towards the very end of the book. In fact, it's the last thing that James says in this letter. In James 5 and in verse 19, the inspired man wrote, "My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." I want to ask you something. Has this ever happened to you? Has someone ever been so concerned for your soul that they have that hard but crucial and critical conversation with you? The conversation that stops you in your tracks and makes you realize just how wrong-headed you have been and how far down the wrong path you have gone. And then you've changed. You made your decision to repent, to come back to the Lord, to start doing right. What do you think about that person who took the time, the consideration, and the love for your soul to tell you something that maybe they were a little apprehensive about talking to you about in the first place? Those conversations are not easy to have, are they? Confrontations like that are scary. But someone loved you enough to do it. What do you think of that person? Chances are you think about what could have happened and the punishment from God that you were saved from. James tells us, let him know in verse 20 that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. Think of the sins that were never committed in the future because somebody cared enough about you and your soul to have that crucial and critical conversation with you. Consider one another in spiritual weakness. Empathize with one another, which is really our final point. We should consider one another in joy and sorrow. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 15, you know this verse. Paul says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. He said in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 26, if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. It got me looking up the word empathize. And it's a word that we use usually interchangeable with the word sympathize. And so I got on Google, because Google knows everything. And so I asked Google, what's the difference between sympathize and empathize? And I got a very subtle yet clear answer. To sympathize with someone is just to express sorrow that they're going through something, right? And we often use that. We sympathize with someone who's going through a difficult time. But to empathize goes further. To empathize means that you can put yourself in the shoes of that person, because maybe you've gone through what it is they're going through. To empathize is to actually feel with the person. In fact, that's what it means. It means in feeling with. You feel with that person because you are in feeling with what they're going through. And this is really what Paul is talking about here. And it's easy to rejoice when times are happy. It's easy when someone maybe has a windfall or something like that, and suddenly they've got a few extra bucks, to rejoice with them. It's easy when something good happens to someone. It's easy. Those are times that are naturally party atmospheres. Those are the times when we are drawn towards one another. But when there are difficult times, when things are hard, those are the times when we tend to isolate more than we assimilate with one another. And we don't really want anybody around when those difficult times are happening. You remember a couple of years ago we went through the book of Job. And when Job was going through his difficulty at the very beginning of the book, when his friends came, and the indication is that some of his friends came from quite far away to be with him. It says in Job that for a week, nobody spoke. They just sat there with him as Job wallowed in his misery. They didn't say anything. The problem for them started when they opened their mouth and started to speak. But for a whole week, they didn't say anything. They just sat there. They were just with Job. And sometimes that's what weeping with those who weep is all about. That's what suffering with those who suffer is all about. It's not about offering words that will help them feel better, because when someone is going through a difficult time, there are no words that can help. They just need to know that they're not alone. So Paul says, weep with those who weep. Sometimes that's hard to do, isn't it? I want to tell you that none of the things that we spoke about this morning is ever going to happen unless we consider ourselves as one body. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. He said over in Philippians chapter 2, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. And we've looked at these passages time and time and time again, and we know what they say. And we can say, like Paul said in Romans chapter 7, I concur with that. I agree with what the Scriptures say. In fact, I heartily agree with the law of God. In my inner man, I know it's right and I want to do it. Well, if we consider one another, we will do it. We'll remember that there is some in this congregation who can be rejoiced with, and there are some that we need to weep with. How will you consider your brothers and your sisters when you leave this place and we go out these doors, and then the real work of being brethren continues? Consider one another. It's not just a neat phrase in the middle of an inspiring passage. It's a commandment from the Lord. Consider one another. We're going to stand in a moment and sing the song. And the song is to get you to consider yourself. Where are you in your relationship with the Lord? Perhaps there is something amiss that you need to let your brothers and sisters know about so that you can get back on the path you know you want to be on. Or maybe there's something else that's bothering you, and you know that you can't work through it unless you have the prayers of your brothers and sisters. In whatever way we can assist you, we want to. Will you come now while we stand and sing?